Talofa Lava, this is Pacific Waves from RNZ Pacific. I'm Susanna Suisuki. Coming up.
For me, it's about trust, it's about fairness, and reinstate that citizen that belong to our people.
A rare display of unity helps the New Zealand Citizenship Bill pass its first reading. Also, some Pasifika families are losing valuable items to pay off big loans. And
I have felt like I was missing something all my life, and just going on this journey, I've found such a deep sense of belonging.
How a string of harsh comments led a Cook Islands media personality to reclaim her heritage. A bill that aims to restore New Zealand citizenship to people born in Samoa between 1924 and 1949 has passed its first reading in Parliament. Surprisingly, ACT and New Zealand First supported the bill from Green Party MP Te Anau Tuiono, while their coalition partner National was the only party to oppose it. Caleb Fotheringham has more.
The Samoan community erupted into singing in Parliament's public gallery last night when the bill got the votes it needed to get to the Select Committee. Reverend Aneteria Sa'u, the Secretary of the Samoan Ministry Fellowship in Wellington, says he's emotional about the outcome. He says the remaining elders deserve the opportunity to become New Zealand citizens.
For me, it's about trust, it's about fairness, and reinstate that citizen that belong to our people. Why didn't they look after us in our first time? Why they reject our right as a citizen now? Now, we were not looking for money, but it's about trust and fairness.
In 1982, the Privy Council ruled that all Western Samoans born between 1924 and 1948 were considered natural-born British subjects and were therefore also New Zealand citizens. However, the same year, the Muldoon government passed the Western Samoa Citizenship Act, effectively overturning the Privy Council ruling. Green Party MP Te Anau Tuiono says his bill will give the opportunity for citizenship to no more than 5,000 people.
The cohort of people that we're talking about, they're getting older, you know, and the youngest of those elders that I was talking about is 75 now, and there's not that many of them left. So the opportunity to address this injustice is now.
Te Pāti Māori backed it, and to the House's surprise, so did ACT.
Madam Speaker, I want to just ease that member's nervousness by saying that ACT Party has decided to support this bill to Select Committee.
New Zealand First MP Casey Costello says it is important for her party that the bill is considered.
I've lived and worked most of my life in South Auckland, and we are enriched and blessed by the contribution Samoan community makes to our schools, to our communities, to our collective organisations.
Labour's Carmel Cipollone says supporting it is in the spirit of the Dawn Raids apology.
Off the back of the significant contribution Samoans have made to Aotearoa, it is the right thing to do.
But National didn't support it, making it the first time the party has been outvoted since coming to power. MP Cameron Brewer argues the bill will set a problematic legal precedent.
The governments of the past, of many stripes, of many different colours, red, blue, green, Te Pāti Māori, others, have not taken this up. And we would argue it's because legally the arguments have been exhausted.
Mr Tuiono hopes National will change its mind.
To be honest, I wasn't sure that the first speaker had actually read the bill. He didn't seem to have a real solid sense of it. Hopefully we can have better and deeper conversations with them through the Select Committee.
Reverend Sa'u is encouraging the Samoan community to reach out to their local MPs and ask them to back the bill as it moves to the Select Committee stage.
Meanwhile, there are concerns of Pasifika families falling victim to loan sharks and unscrupulous pawn loan agreements. Community workers say families have lost invaluable assets. Whenau Whanua has more.
Tapa mats are a lucrative commodity in most Pacific cultures, with some purchased for thousands of dollars. But many tapa mats are not for sale. They hold sentimental value and are only exchanged as gifts in funerals, weddings, or birthdays. They are passed on from generation to generation. But now families are losing these items as they are being loaned out in financial desperation. Auckland-based JP and Tongan community leader Salote Lilo says she's dealt with families who've lost their tapa mats after loaning them out to pawnbrokers and are unable to pay them back.
They're bound to use their assets, which is because it's in a high value, those tapa cloth, and they use that as a security to get some funds somewhere. And I think that's where these loan shark people had the opportunity or chance to scam them, you know, to get the stuff for less cost.
As a JP who certifies financial requests, such as the withdrawing of savings, Lilo says she's seen a noticeable increase in the number of families emptying their KiwiSaver accounts.
I've seen a lot of people walk in this office just to claim their KiwiSaver because they can't afford to pay their rent.
Is that number increasing?
Yes. It's increased since the beginning of this year.
It's not just Auckland that's experiencing this problem. Hamilton-based financial helpline advisor Teresa Alaimoana says she's also dealt with a number of Pacifica families in similar situations. Alaimoana says Pacifica clients typically lend traditional items such as expensive tapa mats in exchange for attractive loans which cannot realistically be paid off.
You know, they'll be in a situation, you know, a desperate situation. So, for example, this was a situation where there was a senior in the family and they needed money quickly. So they've turned to the pawnbroker because that's what they saw was the easiest way to get, you know, to get money.
Pawn loans like these are not illegal if transacted by registered brokers. It's an issue that's currently being evaluated by the New Zealand High Court after New Zealand's Commerce Commission filed proceedings. New Zealand's Commerce Commission told RNZ Pacific in a written statement that it's waiting for a judgment to be made.
The Commission has received several queries from financial mentors around pawnbroking contracts and specific issues including poor affordability assessments, the amount of interest being charged, and a significant increase in the redemption price to extend the term so borrowers can redeem valuable and culturally important belongings. As consumers borrow money under a pawnbroking contract, to what extent they are covered by the Credit Contractors and Consumer Finance Act 2003 is currently being determined by the courts.
There are 45 registered pawn loan shops in New Zealand as of January 2024.
While much of the Western world struggles with depressed economies, the Asian Development Bank, the ADB, is predicting mostly healthy growth across the Pacific over the next several years. The bank's just released its 2024 Asian Development Outlook report, which presents analysis and prospects for the countries of the Asia Pacific. It shows regional growth averaging 3.3% this year and 4.0% in 2025. Inflation will also be higher at 4.3% across the region this year and 4.1% in 2025. The news is most positive for Palau, with 8% growth likely by 2025. But other countries, especially Papua New Guinea, will experience significant growth. ADB economist Karati Neal spoke with Don Wiseman.
We're expecting growth to continue at least in 2024 and 2025, as reported in our Asian Development Outlook publication.
And what will drive that?
Well, in Papua New Guinea, that's going to be driven largely by revived mining activity. There's a major gold mine that reopened recently, and the other large mines in the country are expecting to increase their input. In other parts of the sub-region, we're expecting tourism and construction, mainly of infrastructure projects, to help drive growth in those parts of the Pacific.
Yes, because of the size of the PNG economy, is it effectively carrying the Pacific as far as these figures go?
Yes, our calculations, they're driven by weight. So Papua New Guinea is a significant part of the overall average.
PNG has suffered a number of spectacular setbacks, of course, in the last few years economically. Mm-hmm. Most recently, of course, the rioting back in January. How significant are events like that for the economic situation there?
So the situation in January that did affect a number of local businesses, jobs were lost and a lot of stock was lost or damaged. And it's going to take a while for these businesses to rebuild. So it's going to definitely affect prices. So the inflation is expected to increase a bit in Papua New Guinea over the next couple of years, partly due to the situation. And I think the pace at which they're able to reestablish their businesses would also affect economic growth, particularly in the trade sectors.
Looking at some of the other countries individually around the region, now, Palau is anticipating huge growth. What's that based on?
There is significant growth expected in Palau. It's largely because they're expecting visitor arrivals to increase further in the coming years. There's been a general increase over the past year relative to pre-pandemic levels, but they're still a bit below that. So they're expecting further increases over the next couple of years. And at the same time, they're also going to implement a number of public infrastructure projects that should also help stimulate the economy and help drive growth.
And in the Cook Islands also, very good growth. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and same story as well for them. I think tourism arrivals, they're close to pre-pandemic levels now from what we've observed, and they're expecting continued growth in the sector, although perhaps capacity constraints among hotels and facilities may be close to being reached already, but they're also expecting a couple of major infrastructure projects to be implemented, and that would also help drive growth in the Cooks.
Yet close by Niue, not looking very flash at all by comparison.
Well, not so much, maybe. For one thing, I think they are expecting tourism to improve, if I'm not mistaken. However, we're not really seeing a lot of these infrastructure projects in the pipeline, at least. I'm not aware of any in ADB yet. So that may change, but that also remains to be seen whether the story would be the same for Niue.
Vanuatu, of course, is a very tourism-reliant country, but it's also been through a horrendous time with the weather, with several cyclones and a lot of damage. Mm-hmm. But the reconstruction after those cyclones, that is actually proving to be a boost for the economy there.
It is. In the Pacific, you know, as we're all well aware, a lot of our economies, they're very vulnerable to disasters and the effects of climate change. So there is some stimulus from reconstruction projects. Of course, starting from a very low base, the fact that reconstruction has, there are projects that are giving jobs to people, and then there are follow-on effects on, you know, as they spend their wages, it also benefits the trade sector, for instance, and the transport sector, to name a couple.
Yes, and Vanuatu is one of those countries that's very highly reliant on seasonal workers traveling to Australia and New Zealand and I think now to Canada. So how significant is that money coming into the country?
It is very significant. I do know that Vanuatu is one of the biggest exporters of labor abroad, seasonal labor, among our Pacific economies. So for these countries, remittances are significant. People do send quite a bit of money home. You know, it helps finance education for families and home improvements for the families in the home countries. And it has boosted consumption in the home country. So we also noted, of course, that during the pandemic, there were increases in remittances being sent home. And there is anecdotal evidence that this was very helpful in tiding households over the economic difficulties of the pandemic.
Is the removal of those workers from their home countries, is that a problem in terms of labor availability?
Well, it hasn't been easy to replace the workers who have left. So there are some shortages being reported in a number of Pacific economies and in critical sectors like tourism, construction, and the like. And we just discussed that tourism and construction are two significant drivers of growth in the economy. So there are some implications, but there are also opportunities, of course, for governments, for policymakers to revisit their education and training policies, for instance, and firm up the pathways, I think, to addressing these labor gaps, as well as balancing that with sustaining remittance flows.
Radio personality and filmmaker Chelsea Cuthers Monroe will be debuting her documentary, The Waka That Waited, sharing her personal journey of reconnecting with her Cook Islands heritage. Subjected to backlash and harsh online comments in response to her Cook Islands piece in 2019, Chelsea vowed she would never do anything cultural again. However, she decided to push through and reclaim her cultural identity. Tiana Haxton spoke to Chelsea Cuthers Monroe to hear more about the documentary.
So I had a moment where I was just like, you know, kind of stuff it. And then I got to a point where I was like, no, you know, this is a problem. I can either sit and cry about it or I can do something about it. And so from that point onwards, I decided that every single year for Cook Islands Language Week, I would initiate a project to lead me back to my Cook Islands heritage. The reason I created this documentary was to stand in the gap for all those that felt feelings of inadequacy and unworthiness around claiming their culture as first generation, second generation New Zealand born Cook Islanders. And I just want everyone to know that if you akapapa, it's in your blood and that's enough, permission enough for you to explore your cultural heritage.
Amazing. So all about, you know, reclaiming your cultural heritage and I guess a healing journey for you. How has this journey been? You know, where has it brought you to now in this current day?
It's been the most healing journey of my life. It's been such a wholesome journey. It was funny because I was looking for answers, and the answers in my head at the time when I started this project was to be found in learning fluent Te Reo Māori Tuku Ki Arani. That's what I thought I had to get to achieve a sense of pride and a sense of belonging in my culture. Little did I know, it was actually through the journey was where I found my answers. It was by going back to my homelands, looking into my family genealogy, connecting through ancestral wisdom and knowledge through our elders, sitting and listening to our elders, talking to my nana, holding space to hear different perspectives. And I think it's been such a beautiful process of actually unpacking the complexities and actually understanding why I am here as a second generation New Zealand born Cook Islander in Auckland, why I do have language barriers, why I have felt like I was missing something all my life. And so just going on this journey, I've found such a deep sense of belonging and actually moving out from this shame, blame and trauma and pointing fingers to a place of healing through compassion, through empathy, and through, just listening, being open and having grace for myself on the journey as for others as well.
And you mentioned having gone back home to the Cook Islands, and I know you did a lot of your filming for this documentary there back home. Can you tell us a little bit about what are we going to see on screen on your premiere night?
As an Indigenous storyteller, I love visual storytelling. And so there's a lot of nostalgia. There's a lot of the New Zealand scene back in the 1960s. We've gone to the archives, which has been such a crazy experience. And then even Raro back in the 1930s, we managed to source some footage, 1920s. So people will be taken on a journey of nostalgia, of Cook Islands history, and of my own story as well. I think a big part of this documentary as well is, you know, feelings around shame and blaming. Part of this documentary, I want it to be a mirror reflection of every Cook Islander sitting in the room, whether they were like me and I didn't really identify as a Cook Islander, whether they were the well-seasoned, bilingual, fluent-speaking Cook Islanders. I think we all have a part to play, and in order to heal as one people and to be able to go forward, we all need each other, and we've all got something from our journey to gift one another. There's an exchange that takes place of old and new and a fusion of traditional and being open to new ways of adapting and navigating new waters as times do change. So I really want this documentary to just promote healing through empathy and compassion.
Amazing. I can't wait. And for those listening in, when and where are you going to be having your premiere? And how can people interested in attending come along?
A first official screening tomorrow night, Friday the 12th of April, From 5 p.m. onwards, we have a pre-show, and then we also have the program starting at 6 o'clock tomorrow. So if people are interested, they can go to the Māngere Arts Centre, and they can go to Event Finder and type in the Baka That Waited, and they can find that there as well. We've also had so much interest from overseas, also people in Australia, America, back home in the Cook Islands. So I'm really hoping to take this documentary on a little bit of a tour back to Rarotonga. We're looking for sponsorship at the moment and taking it back down to Wellington, where obviously we've got a big pocket of our Cook Islands community down there as well. But yeah, the official screening plus a live Q&A panel with some key figures of our community tomorrow night at the Māngere Arts Centre.
Thank you so much for your time, Charles. All the best for Friday night.
That's Pacific Waves for today. To listen back, head over to rnzi.com/programs. We're also on Spotify, Apple and iHeartRadio. From myself and the RNZ Pacific team, Tōwhā Suifua.